Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on 1 Second After when we come back. You know, back in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. Now, these global 2,000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, disease, plague, and pestilence to reduce the Earth's population by some 90% over the next 50 years, so says the Club of Rome. Now, in Revelation chapter 6, the God of Israel told us exactly the same thing in essentially the same terms. He said false prophets, war, famine, and disease. Back in 1920, nearly 50% of our people lived on the land as subsistence farmers. They produced their own food, and they produced food for the rest of the world and for you and me. Today, we Americans have now chosen to live in our cities, and only 3% of us now live on the land. Now, that means that 97% of us then are no longer self-sufficient in our food production. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, all right, and then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. And our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 world population control program. And these globalists, with their genocide agenda, have a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause, and let you and I live for ours. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is available on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. All right, we're talking about 1 Second After. It's a book written by a fellow named Forschen, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N. You got to write that down. Probably a $20 book, something like that. It's good entertainment, if you like entertainment, but it's better than that. It's a story about an EMP attack against the United States. EMP, electromagnetic pulse. You probably, if you're like I, never heard that term before. I'd heard of neutron bomb, not heard that one. But this electromagnetic pulse was a new experience for me. And when I got into the book and I said, oh my God, now I can see what's coming down the pike. Because when I finished the book, I said, you know, if I was the chief strategist in Russia or China, that's exactly what I would do. Because it would multiply the chaos. It would multiply the effectiveness of my nuclear strike against the United States or Great Britain or France. It would so devastate the country economically and its ability to fight back or to even subsist. It's one of the best weapons, I think, that's ever been created by the wicked, evil mind of Satan himself. It's a weapon that knocks out all of the electronic equipment in the nation. Not just in your local area, but in the entire nation. The electric grid goes down. All of the automobiles stop. All of your diesel trucks don't run. Now, I know you're going to sit there and say, oh, no, you can't knock it all out. Well, you're right. You can't. And in the story, this guy has a 1958 Edsel. And because it doesn't have electronic ignition, he can run his old Edsel automobile. It's an old classic car. And he's driving around when everybody else is shut down. And as time progresses along, they get a couple of Volkswagens running and a Willys Jeep. And they get a bunch of stuff running. Now, the problem that they have is that there's no gasoline deliveries. And so they've only got gasoline, which is in the ground or in the tanks. And gasoline doesn't keep very long. So gasoline has a very short shelf life. And, of course, the police come in and they take all the available gasoline supplies. And since their cars are all electronic and nothing works, they, through martial law, take over all the automobiles that do run. So if you thought you were going to use your old Willys Jeep or something like that, you can forget it. The sheriff's going to come out and take that away from you. They're going to declare martial law, of course, and that's necessary. And I'm not finding fault with the concepts that are put together here in the martial law, because there's thugs, armed thugs running around and just killing people and taking what they've got. And so you've got to have a system set up in short order here to deal with this. And no doubt the local authorities will do that. They'll declare martial law. You'll have your sheriff and police agents over here. They'll establish and they'll maintain order at the local level. Where it breaks down is at the national level, because you can't communicate with Washington or Jefferson City or Tallahassee. And until that communication is reestablished, you've got chaos reigning supreme. And since the trucks don't run, now let's just take a look at your diesel truck. See, I can remember a time years ago when you wanted to shut off a diesel engine, you pulled a cord. And it physically shut off the fuel to the engine, and the engine died down. Today, that's all done electronically. The fuel pumps that are pumping the fuel in these diesel trucks are electronic. So, when the electromagnetic pulse goes off, all the diesel trucks are going to stop. Doesn't mean that they can't be repaired. If you've got the replacement parts on the shelf, sure, you can replace those. Let me ask you this. If you went down to O'Reilly's or went to the O'Reilly warehouse and said, okay, we've got 3,000 trucks over here and the electronic equipment in the truck has been burned out and we need to replace it. I'm sure that O'Reilly's is going to have 10 or 15 of those in their warehouse. Now, where are you going to get the other 2,985? They got to come from Detroit or Los Angeles or Philadelphia or Dallas or Houston or someplace. So, yes, it is true. There are a few thousand of those around. And a few thousand trucks are going to be back in service in a short period of time. You know, a day, two, a week, two, something like that. But boys and girls, we depend on tens of thousands of trucks, and all of them are going to be knocked out. And to get tens of thousands of those computers and those boards, you know, those motherboards and et cetera, and those electronic components is going to take time. And that's where the chaos ensues. And that's where the famine comes in. And that's where the shortages develop. Now, there's a story in here on page 222 that deals with diabetics. And what happens to the people in your community who are diabetics? Now, that's a pretty common disease. Here in the United States, we have several million. I don't know exactly how many without looking up the number. But, you know, let's say there's 10, 15 million people in the country that have diabetes. Now, the diabetes medication, insulin, is manufactured around the country. There's probably somebody manufacturing insulin in Dallas, Texas. And probably they're manufacturing it in Los Angeles and New York and St. Paul, Minnesota. There's probably, 10, 15 places manufacturing it. And then they distribute it out from there, say it's from St. Paul. So you people that are in Des Moines, Iowa, probably get your insulin supply from St. Paul. And Bismarck, North Dakota, and so on, up there in the north central states. And let's suppose that we have an electromagnetic pulse and all the trucks are knocked out and all the supplies are knocked out. Tens of thousands of cars are stalled along the freeways and highways and one thing and another. What happens to the diabetics? Well, in our little town in South Carolina, population 10,000, here's a sample of it. "Good work, Doc," Charlie said. "Well, I better go from that to the downside of things. In one sense, we are in what I would call the grace period right now, the calm between the storms. Our initial die-off in the first days after the EMP went off, those needing major medical intervention, the first round of food poisoning, and those woefully out of shape, accounted for approximately 1,200 of the 10,000 or so deaths. 500 of them were in Black Mountain and Swanoa. We still don't have an exact figure on those who had died in the first few days, but it had to be well over 1,000. So let's put our total number at 12,000, then back down to roughly 10,000 or so. That doesn't count the casualties from the fighting at the Gap and the refugees that are dying outside the barrier," Tom interjected. "No," Doc Keller replied. "I'm only counting those who died of natural causes at the moment. What I'm saying is that those who we expect to die quickly have pretty well died off. Now, in the next 15 days or so, the number should be fairly low, so long as we keep the community stable and nothing exotic sneaks in on us. But then, I hate to say this, it's going to start sliding up again, and within 30 days it'll be far worse than anything that we've seen so far." Doc Keller hesitated, looking at John for a moment. Keller knew from his experience his secret regarding the stash of insulin. "Nearly all of our type 1 diabetics will die this month. The pharmacies in general allocated one bottle of 1,000 units per person. That supply of insulin is now running out for them. So we can expect all of them, approximately 120 in our community, to start dying." No one spoke. "Other deaths that we can expect in the coming month are severe asthmatics running short on their rescue inhalers, and several heart arrhythmia patients running out of beta blockers. So I think we're in the middle of the lull before the next wave of deaths hits. There's another issue as well, though, that I don't think many of us have thought of. But Tom, you better start gearing up for it. We might have to start thinking about taking over a building as another isolation ward." "What for?" Kate asked. Doc Keller paused and said, "Severe psychoses." "You mean insanity?" Tom asked. "Hell, we're already seeing enough crazies coming in at the Gap, not to mention the suicides over the last month. I think we're all about half crazy now." "Well, it's going to get a lot worse than that," Doc Keller said. "Why, within days?" Tom interjected. "About a quarter of the population was on antidepressants or on anti-anxiety agents, things like Prozac and Xanax and Lexapro, even just plain old lithium. Most of those people rushed to the pharmacies and they stocked up. But even then, on average, a person got at best a 30-day supply. Well, now we're running out. Withdrawal for some won't be too bad. For others, symptoms will be severe, including hallucinations. Compound that with the stress that everyone's already under. As an old-time doctor, I'll be the first to tell you quite a few of these people that are on medications now were just mildly neurotic, living in a very pampered society where it was almost obligatory to have some sort of disorder. But seriously, about 5% of our population do have severe disorders. And 1 or 2% have dangerous disorders that include severe paranoia and the potential for highly aggressive behavior. In other words, expect a lot of insanity, Tom said. You'll be the one that has to deal with it, Doc Keller replied. And I think your people better be briefed on it. Not too long ago, in our past, families suffered with it, keeping their crazy Uncle Louie restrained or locked away in an asylum, or shipping them to some state hospital that were indeed snake pits. Where do you think the word bedlam came from? It was the hospital for the insane in 18th century England, and judging by my old prints, it was a true hellhole. But we haven't dealt with this ever since all the modern meds started coming out in the 60s and 70s. And that, with the changing of laws, pretty well stopped involuntary commitment, except in extreme cases. It emptied out the hospitals. Well, if it was 50 years ago, at least 100 of our fellow citizens would already be under some form of restraint, either at home or in a state institution. But today, they're not locked up. Today, they're with us, right here in the community. And the medications that kept them somewhat stable are now gone. Hundreds more are in varying degrees of instability as well. And what I'm trying to get across to everyone here is that we'll have upwards of 1,000 people in our community, about 10% of our population, who are experiencing some form of psychological unbalance, not related at all to the crisis, but instead, it's related to their forced withdrawal from these medications. And at least 50 to 100 will be extremely dangerous to themselves and dangerous to others. Several paranoids, schizophrenics, delusional personalities, and several people living here with criminal pasts who were declared insane, treated, and then released back into the community. I think, Charlie, you're going to have someone authorize me to be able to declare people mentally unstable and to then incarcerate them by force. We'll need then to find people to tend to them and guard them. And we'll also have to decide how we want to deal with the food distribution to these people. Charlie sighed, rubbing his beard, and then nodded. All right, I authorize you, Doc Keller, to have the authority to declare a person to be mentally deranged and to have them incarcerated, and if need be, against their will or that of their families. Tom, you'll be responsible for their arrest. I'll post the notice later today. Dr. Keller nodded. From the book, 1 Second After, page 224. Think about that now for a minute, boys and girls. Here in America, we no longer have institutions for the mentally unbalanced or the mentally insane. We've had these people on medications like Prozac, and these people are with us right now today, and it's about 10% of our population. Out of 300 million people in the country, 30 million of them are mentally unstable and on some kind of Prozac or some kind of a medication. Now, when this occurs, there will be medication out there for these people for a period of time, and if this thing can blow over in 30 days, you'll be probably in Fat City. If you can get supplies of insulin to these people within 30 days, you probably can save them. If you can get supplies of Prozac and other medications to these people that are mentally unbalanced, you probably can get by this. But in the book, One Second After, this thing goes on for month after month after month. In fact, after 9 months, we get back to the afterword in the story. They're just barely getting to the point where they're making communications. They've got a radio station or two, AM stations, that are up and running and telling what's going on in the country, that the president's been killed and Congress is disbanded, that Washington, D.C. has been obliterated from the map, but that there is a government, a national government, that is operating in exile. That's when you get to the end of the book. And what this boils down to is that all of the people in the country, not just in this little town, but all the people in the country, are reduced to operating in the local communities. Only the local communities will function. The state governments aren't functioning. County governments aren't functioning. The national government doesn't function. Social Security checks, boys and girls, aren't going out. OSHA and the EPA, the IRS, don't work. There isn't any tax collection. There isn't any tax dispersal. And people are reduced here to dealing directly with the farmers in the local community. And in this town in South Carolina, it poses a real problem because they don't have grain production in South Carolina. They produce tobacco. They got plenty of smokes. They don't get anything to eat. And the grain, which is over here in the Midwest, there isn't any transportation. So you can't get the grain in the Midwest distributed to the rest of the country. So the grain is rotting here in the Midwest, and the people on the East Coast and the West Coast are starving to death because they can't get any grain. Lots of strawberries in Monterey and Salinas, California. And they just don't have any grain to go with it. Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because here in the United States, we depend upon just-in-time delivery, not just for the auto parts that we buy out of O'Reilly's. Our strawberries come from California, and they're distributed all over the country. The lettuce that you people in New York eat in the restaurants comes from the Salinas Valley of California. And it takes a 5-day ride by refrigerated railroad car from Salinas to New York. The oranges come from California, Florida, and Texas. Yes, it's true, you've got oranges in Bismarck, North Dakota, but there aren't any orange trees up there. It's transportation from Florida, Texas, and California that puts those oranges in your supermarkets in Bismarck and Fargo. I mean, that's where reality is located. Now, the grain is produced here in the Midwest, but it's shipped all over the nation. Grain isn't produced in New York, Florida, California. It's true, California produces a lot of rice, so does Arkansas. And it's then shipped all over America. There isn't any rice being produced in places like Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, Massachusetts. That rice has to be shipped to you. Now just take a look in your supermarket. The problem that we face here in America is that instead of producing at the local level, it used to be that farmers produced wheat, corn, meat, butter, and eggs in the local communities everywhere in America. In fact, right where I'm speaking to you from here in Isabella, Missouri, this used to be in the region which was the fruit orchard of America. Back in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, we had lots of fruit trees here and canneries everywhere. But over time, big monopolies came in and set up the fruit distributing plants and the fruit growing places in America in places like California. Now, tremendous amounts of fruit are produced in California. And we depend upon you Californians to produce peaches and plums and pears and avocados and then distribute those to the rest of the nation. And as long as the distribution system's up and running, God, the system works like a shot. But the minute that the transportation system breaks down or the electrical grid goes down, there won't be any more distribution from California out here. You'll have all kinds of peaches in California. I don't know whether you'll be able to get those peaches from Merced, California to Eureka, California. That's another problem. But by God, you people there in Merced are going to have all kinds of fruit. Now, you may not have any wheat. you might not have other foodstuffs over there like ketchup or mustard, you know, to put on it, but you're going to have plenty of fruit. And that's what our problem is. We have specialized to such a degree that you've got all this stuff in one location, but you don't have enough of anything that you can distribute. And if the distribution system breaks down, it's curtains for all of us. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 28, there's a story in there that deals with famine, an acute famine, a god-awful famine, a famine that only comes from biblical sources. It's biblical in its scope. Let me describe it for you. In fact, throughout history, we've never seen anything like this happen. It's never happened before. Even in the 1,000-day siege around Stalingrad and Leningrad, when the Germans were in the heart of World War II, when for years, you know, these cities were surrounded and being fought over, they never had cannibalism like this. It's in Deuteronomy 28, and it's over here about verse 53. It says, "You shall eat the fruit of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters, which the Eternal your God has given you, in the siege, in the straitness, wherewith your enemies shall distress you. So that the man that is tender among you and very delicate, his eye shall be evil toward his brother and toward the wife of his bosom and toward the remnant of his children which he shall leave, so that he will not give to any of them of the flesh of his children whom he shall eat, because he has nothing left him in the siege and in the straitness wherewith your enemy shall distress you in all of your gates. The tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground for delicateness and tenderness, her eye shall be evil toward the husband of her bosom, and toward her son, and toward her daughter, and toward her young one that comes out from between her feet, and toward her children which she shall bear. For she shall eat them, for want of all things, secretly, in the siege and straitness, wherewith your enemy shall distress you in all of your gates. If you will not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that you may fear the glorious and fearful name, the Eternal your God." So if you wanted to know why this is happening, it's because we're in breach of contract. But if you want to know what is happening, it's famine. Now, this famine comes from what's called a siege here in the Bible. A siege. That's where a foreign army surrounds a city that's covered or guarded by a wall. And the invading army can't get inside the wall. And if they come up close to the wall, they get shot from the high ground on the walls. They're being shot with arrows. And so what they would do is they would circle around a city with a huge army. Then the army would cut off all contact with the city. No more food coming in, no goods going out. A total embargo. Sometimes cities would surrender because they ran out of water. So there was a king in Jerusalem, I've forgotten who his name is now, but he dug a 1,600-foot tunnel through solid rock to get to some springs so that the city of Jerusalem could be supplied with water. It was a hell of an engineering and architectural and engineering feat. It's accomplished, and it's there to this day, and the water still runs through the tunnel. And Jerusalem could be surrounded by armies, and they'd have water. But they'd shut off the food. So cities used to have ways by which they could grow food on the housetops. they would store great amounts of food in the city so that if an army came by, they could withstand a siege for up to 3 years. 3 years! You could surround this city. They had water and food for 3 years. They did that at Masada. And the defenders at Masada, you know, they held out for a year or more. But, you know, ultimately, it comes to an end. If you can maintain the siege, by God, the people inside are going to starve to death because they don't have enough, but they can get by on reduced rations. Now, here's a case where we have a siege. Let me describe the siege of America. We Americans back in the 1950s produced so much food in this country that we didn't know where to put it all. We could supply the Marshall Plan, we could feed Europe, we could feed Japan, we could feed ourselves, and we had gigantic surpluses. We had to buy up land, put it in soil bank, and pay farmers to stop growing so much. Times have changed. Today, 50% of the food that you buy in your supermarket comes from outside our borders. The garlic that you're flavoring your roast with comes from China. The grapes that you're eating come from Chile. The berries you're eating come from Guatemala. Those kiwis come from Australia, New Zealand. It's not just the bananas and the kiwis. It's the staples. The butter. Milk. Fluid milk is produced here in the country, but the cheese. You know that Brie cheese from France? The butter from Holland? Yeah, you take a look at where this food's coming from, and all of a sudden, half of it. Now, it's worse than that. Our trade balance around the world works like this. We're importing about $800 billion a year worth of goods, and we're exporting $200 billion a year. So, three-quarters of what we consume in this country comes from outside our borders. And we're bankrupt. We, along with 19 other first world industrialized countries, you know, countries like Portugal and Spain and Italy and Greece, and Iceland, England, the United States. Now, some countries aren't bankrupt. You Canadians aren't bankrupt. You Australians aren't. Norwegians aren't. But many of us are bankrupt. And we depend upon the foodstuffs. We depend upon the industrial goods, tennis shoes, big screen TVs, automobile parts. That all comes from Germany and China and Japan and other countries around the world. And when those countries shut those off, we are going to be under siege. Under siege. When they cut off our food and our supplies coming in, it'll work just like an army surrounding our walls. Can't get it in. Can't get it out. Can't pay for it. That's the bottom line. Can't pay for it. And when that siege comes, boys and girls, described here in Deuteronomy 28, it's going to be the worst famine in the history of the world. Never before and never again a famine like the one coming. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. And it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click on to the archives page, and download that free general law CD package for yourself. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, they're mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing the book One Second After in conjunction with Alas, Babylon. Now, the book Alas, Babylon is written by a fellow named Pat Frank. Both of them are fictional accounts of nuclear bomb war, and I'm reviewing them in conjunction with Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, and Revelation 6, those chapters in the Scripture that deal with the United States and Western Europe in Bible prophecy as it relates to the coming Great Tribulation. Now, in the book One Second After, there is an afterword, and it's written by a fellow who is a U.S. Air Force retired former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Strategic Command. It is not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so says General Eugene Habiger, H-A-B-I-G-E-R, U.S. Air Force retired, former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Strategic Command in May of 2002. Now, not only does the afterword in the book share or tell us a great deal about what we can expect, this afterword is written by a Captain Bill Sanders in the U.S. Navy, who's been trained in the use of or the defense against these EMPs. And I wanted to put this in conjunction with the book itself and with the EMP problem, because while it's a fictional account, the Chinese have it in their minds that they can defeat us, and they're waiting for the right moment. The Russians, you know, we think that the Russians have given up on communism. This is a ruse that's been used now for the last, 30 years, 20 years anyway, maybe 30. That, hey, listen, we're really not your enemies, we're your friends, and that's why you can depend on us and you can trade with us. Now, our Creator told us that these people are our mortal enemies, that these people have it in their minds that they're going to kill us. They want to destroy us. These are our worst nightmares. And we're over here buying, selling, and trading, giving them our technology and our secrets and one thing and another. And it's going to come back and bite us in the butt. That's the bottom line. Now, here's the afterword. Listen to this. Electromagnetic pulse, a bolt from the gray. The fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union marked a distinct turning point in my Navy career. The Boeing E-6 strategic nuclear command and control aircraft that I flew would no longer fly continuous airborne alert positioned and postured for a bolt from the blue nuclear attack. I continue to hope that if military anthropologists ever decide to study pre-Cold War hunter-gatherer groups, my rather unspectacular career will be noted for only two significant statistics: no aircraft lost, and no nuclear holocaust on my watch. Growing up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, I was captivated by the subject of nuclear war, and somehow it became my career path. I leapt at the chance to tour the Nevada test site as an ensign. As I took in the images of a nuclear ghost town and the enormous crater left by the Sedan event, measuring nearly a quarter of a mile across and deeper than a football field, the tremendous destructiveness of nuclear weapons became real for me. I would devote much of my life to balancing the day-to-day duties of standing ready to fight a strategic nuclear war with the angst of the anticipated aftermath, devouring all that I could on the subject. I read Pat Frank's classic apocalyptic 1959 novel, Alas, Babylon, and was encouraged by man's defiance of annihilation and ability to cope in a post-attack nuclear world. The image of Slim Pickens as Major T.J. King Kong in Dr. Strangelove provided dark comic relief every time I inventoried a double-locked safe of nuclear codes. After being promoted to captain, I reread Neville Shute's classic On the Beach, and I wondered if I could gracefully face the end of civilization with the same courage as the submarine captain Dwight Towers. I wish my imagination would have allowed me to just sit back and enjoy my friend Bill Fortune's novel One Second After as another science fiction story, but I could not. It was an emotional and a gut-wrenching read, because it could actually happen. An electromagnetic pulse, EMP, explosion over the continental United States would have a devastating consequence for our country. The detonation of a nuclear weapon produces high-energy gamma radiation that travels radially away from the burst center. When the detonation occurs at high altitudes, that is, greater than 25 miles, the gamma rays directed towards the Earth encounter the atmosphere, where they interact with the air molecules to provide positive ions and recoil electrons called Compton electrons, after the physicist who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1927 for his discovery of the Compton effect. The gamma radiation interacting with the air molecules produces charge separation as the Compton recoil electrons are ejected and leave behind the more massive positive ions. The Earth's magnetic field, with its interaction with the Compton recoil electrons, causes charge acceleration, which further radiates an electromagnetic field as an instantaneous electromagnetic pulse. Additionally, a high-altitude nuclear burst also produces a relatively slow magnetic hydrofluoretic EMP, whose effects are like those from geomagnetic solar storm disturbances, causing the flow of very low-frequency current into the Earth and into long transmission lines. The reality of the damage to electrical and electronic equipment by EMP has been established in various nuclear tests and by the use of EMP simulators. The intense and invisible energy pulse cannot be sensed by people, and it does not damage the human body. Unlike a lightning strike, an EMP explosion is both much faster in producing damaging power surges and much broader and far-reaching in causing simultaneous burnout and failure of electrical and electronic systems over a large area. A well-designed nuclear weapon detonated at a high altitude over Kansas could have damaging effects over virtually the entire continental United States. Our technologically oriented society and its heavy dependence on advanced electronic systems could be brought to its knees with cascading failures of our critical infrastructure. Our vulnerability increases daily as our use and dependence on electronics continues to accelerate. A former speaker, Newt Gingrich, describes the potential catastrophic consequences of an EMP attack over the United States. He notes that this is not idle speculation, but taken from the consensus findings of 9 distinguished American scientists who authored the report of the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from Electromagnetic Pulse EMP Attack. Unfortunately, the report of the Commission to Assess the Threat to the United States from this electromagnetic pulse attack was released the exact same day the 9/11 Commission's report directed most of America's immediate attention to the rearview mirror to find out why we failed to prevent the horrific terrorist attack of 2001. As television commentators pored over the 9/11 report, and they offered in-depth analysis of the failure of the imagination, the stark warnings and recommendations of the EMP Commission went largely unnoticed into the backlogged pile of congressional failures of implementation. So why are we reluctant to realistically address the threat of an EMP attack? Skeptics will continue to regurgitate bureaucratic babble, such as while it is technically feasible, it is highly improbable. Or some other technological babble, such as we do not have any credible intelligence indications, and we must remain focused on near-term concerns. And other canned responses of downplayed threat perceptions prevalent prior to 9/11. Fortunately, while there is no clear objective method for analyzing relative risks and costs for comparing large-scale disasters, there is a high value to preventing, preparing for, and being able to recover from large-scale disasters such as hurricanes, floods, and regional power outages. The thorough work of the EMP Commission provides a clear look at the nature of the problem, mitigation strategies, and recommendations. The solution is visible and well within our means and resources to accomplish. One of the EMP commissioners, Dr. Lowell Wood, a noted nuclear physicist involved with EMP weapons for more than 30 years, characterizes an EMP event as a continental time machine that would move us back to about the 19th century. When questioned what the technology of a century ago could not support our present population, he unemotionally replied, "Yes, I know." The population will shrink until it can be supported by that 19th century technology. Farming expertise, horses and mules, would be in short supply. As EMP weapons do not distinguish between military and civilian targets, it is especially critical that our electrical power infrastructure be hardened against an EMP attack. An EMP attack would not be viewed as a Cold War bolt from the blue, but rather prepared for as an anticipated asymmetric bolt from the gray. We have been warned that our country is vulnerable and virtually unprotected against an EMP attack that could damage or destroy civilian and military critical electronic infrastructures, triggering catastrophic consequences that could cause the permanent collapse of our society. 1 second after an EMP attack, it will be too late to ask two simple questions. What would or what should we have done to prevent this attack, and why didn't we do it? So says Captain Bill Sanders of the U.S. Navy. Well, the answer is nobody can prepare for something that they can't visualize. It's esoteric. It's something that, yes, maybe, but not in my lifetime. That's why Bible prophecy is scoffed at, laughed at, ridiculed, made fun of. It's an event that's coming, but it is so severe that we cannot imagine it. And so we put it out of our minds. First of all, because we don't understand it, and secondly, because we don't want to believe it. This EMP attack. After I read the book, I said to myself, if I were on the other side, that's exactly what I would do. Exactly. Think of it. When you drop a bomb on Los Angeles, it will only be seconds before that information is relayed to Washington, D.C. and to the Strategic Air Command. When an EMP attack occurs, in 1 second, all communications will be blotted out. Nobody from Los Angeles will be able to tell any satellite to relay a communication from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. Now, it is true that the military have hardened their communications. And it is true that they used to harden the telephone communications. But let's think about this now for a second. Let's suppose that in the event of an EMP attack, you wake up and you say, oh my God, I think we've had an EMP attack. I think I will call my mother in Seattle, Washington. So you pick up your cell phone. And what happens? Son, your cell phone has been fried. And furthermore, your mother's cell phone in Seattle has been fried. And you say, but the telephone office and their computer equipment has been hardened. So what in the hell does that do for you and your mother? I know. I'll go in and get on my landline. Sorry, partner. Since the 1960s, all telephones are transistorized. And if they're not transistorized, then they're computerized. Now, while it's true that some of the telephone exchanges have been hardened, of what value is that to you and me? The telephone exchange in Theodosia is up and running. It's just that there aren't any telephones out there to use the exchange. They've all been fried because they're all in our houses, and our houses aren't hardened. So our telephones at both ends are gone. Our cell phones are gone. Even if the cell phone tower has been hardened and it's up and running, none of the rest of us have any telephones with which to use the telephone tower or the telephone exchange. It kind of reminded me of the story of Anne Frank. Back in 1939, this little Jewish girl and her family went into hiding from the Germans. And they were in Holland, and they were hiding in the attic of these people's house. So they hid out in 1939, 1940, 1941, 1942, 1943. They did a hell of a job. They were out of harm's way. The end of the war is coming. We can see by 1943, 1944, Germany is going to lose. Hang on, Anne. Hang on. But in September of 1944, they were found. Listen, in September of 1944, Holland was freed by the Allies. September and October. They were captured in September, sent to Auschwitz, and they all died. They were within 30 days. If they could have held out until the Allies had completed the invasion and occupation of Holland, they would have been saved. But they didn't. So I ask the question of what value was it then that they hid out for 5 years and succeeded in eluding the Germans for 5 years, because in the final analysis, in the end, they failed. That's what subsistence and survival is about. We have 64 life-threatening problems. You know, things like war, famine, disease, earthquakes, flood, tornadoes, and hurricanes. Well, EMP adds number 65. Which goes along with economic collapse, roving gangs, and so on. You have to survive every single one of those. And if you fail to survive every single one of these 65 problems, you're dead. So therefore, you not only have to know what these 65 problems are, you've got to have a plan in place for each and every one of them. Otherwise, if you succeed and you save yourself out of 63 of them, but the 64th one gets you or the 65th one gets you, well then, of what value was it to you? So the Franks can say, well, we lived in these horrible conditions in the attic, in cramped space, hiding out in fear of our lives for 5 years. But in the final analysis, we failed and we all got killed. I would rather say, hey, listen, I toughed it out here for 10 years. I made my preparations. And when it was all said and done, I survived it and I witnessed the second coming of the Messiah. I succeeded in surviving the great tribulation. I mean, you know, not too many people are going to do that. The Messiah himself said in Matthew 24 that this is the worst event that the world has ever seen. 80% of Americans now polled believe that an economic collapse is now possible. Boys and girls, 5 years ago, if I would have asked you, do you believe that an economic collapse in America is possible, you'd have laughed and said, you ought to be out of your mind. This is the strongest economy in the world. America and the dollar is the reserve currency for the entire world. I would have said, well, yeah, you're right, in 2007. But now we're in 2010, and in just 36 months, every nation in the world is now selling dollars because they're all suspicious that America is bankrupt and cannot pay its bonds. The Chinese have dropped from 67 to 60% now, and they're buying gold. The Japanese are the biggest holders of U.S. bonds. Well, I guess the Chinese have now taken over again. But they're in a race to the bottom, boys and girls. All of the nations are now dumping dollars. 3 years ago, you'd have said, that's impossible. Today, I come on the air and I say, have you thought about an EMP? You know, 25 years ago, we'd have said, well, that's kind of impossible, but not today. Hey, I'm out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information, then call the law school and ask us. Go to our website, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. We are open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.